From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. Later on, Dr. J. Marvin Herndon joins us as we talk about the Corps. And I'm not talking about the Marines. Get ready for that. Well, a problem that I believe could be of biblical proportions in Japan. Radiation continuing to spew from damaged reactors at a crippled nuclear power plant and the tsunami ravaged northeastern Japan in a very dramatic escalation of the four-day-old catastrophe. The prime minister has warned residents to stay inside or risk getting radiation sickness. The chief cabinet secretary there said that a fourth reactor at the Fukushima complex was on fire and that more radiation was being released. Now, the Japanese government has claimed that radioactive material from its stricken power plants has not traveled more than 20 miles from the plants, but the U.S. aircraft carrier Ronald Reagan has had to clean radioactive material off its decks 60 miles out to sea. Sailors on deck have received a month's worth of radiation in one day as they passed through a radioactive cloud as they arrived in Japan. American helicopters flying missions near the damaged reactors became coated with radioactive particles that had to be washed off. Civilians here in the United States, especially those on the West Coast, want to know if winds from Japan will blow any radiation our way. Officials claim that any radiation that reaches the U.S. would be too weak to do any harm. Should we believe them? The prevailing winds over Japan are now blowing eastward across the Pacific. If this continues, international stations for radioactive tracking located at Wake or Midway Islands might detect radiation sometime this week. Scott Porzline has kept watch on security issues at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania for 25-plus years. He's on the line with us here. Scott, let me ask you first and foremost, the situation in Japan, they're presenting it as if it's serious, but not that bad. What's going on over there?
Well, Unit 2 is worsening by the hour, and it's in big trouble. We might be going through the looking glass right now. In fact, they just set up a no-fly zone in a 30-kilometer radius over the plant, and they've already detected higher than normal radiation levels in Tokyo. So what has happened is there's been some progress at Unit 1 and 3, but Unit 2 is really in trouble from the latest explosion. What happened, the Unit 2 was they were attempting to cool it with a feed-and-bleed technique using seawater. That's where they allow some of the gases to escape that are radioactive to make room for some of the seawater to be injected into the reactor. When that's called the feed part, the bleeds when they allow it to come out the top. Then an explosion happened at Unit 3, and immediately the operators lost the ability to do the bleeding operation at Reactor Unit Number 2. So now they have the buildup of these dangerous gases, including hydrogen, within the reactor vessel itself and inside the primary containment. When the temperatures reach 2,200 degrees Fahrenheit, the fuel tubes, the fuel rods, started to fail. They disintegrate. More hydrogen is created. You have this buildup inside the concrete shell that surrounds the reactor vessel, and that hydrogen exploded. It was stronger than the other two blasts, and it happened inside the building right next to the reactor rather than in the outer shell that blew the roofs off the other days. So that's when radiation started to be released in dangerous amounts. We probably have some sort of failed reactor vessel. It could be a rupture. It could be a valve stuck open, and that's what's allowing the radioactive contamination to go right out now into the failed torus. It's called the torus or the wet well portion of the plant. And so from there, it has a pathway to the environment. We may be looking at the beginning of a full-scale meltdown if they can't keep up with the amount of seawater they need to pump
into that. And what does that mean, Scott? If there's a full-scale meltdown in terms of health to the Japanese and health to the rest of the planet, what does that mean?
Well, it would be catastrophic for the area, and it depends on which way the wind is blowing. Even here in the United States, it would cause some cancers, but it would be almost undetectable in the sense of who got cancer. Just like people got cancers from the atmospheric bomb testing, the whole world agreed that was a problem. We shut that down. The same thing would happen with this type of a plume that would circle the globe. This could be worse than Chernobyl, especially if something you're not hearing too much about, if the spent fuel pools also go up. Right now, they're having trouble keeping circulation going through the spent fuel pool on top of Unit 1 near that explosion. If that pool has been compromised and it's leaking water faster than they can make up, eventually that fuel becomes uncovered. Well, there may be 25 cores worth of fuel, spent fuel, in that pool. In other words, Chernobyl times 10, if that were to catch fire and go up.
We better say a prayer, Scott, huh?
Oh, my, yes. It's very grave.
Thank you, Scott. We'll be in touch with you earlier for the rest of this week. Concerns about possible radiation from Japan's earthquake-damaged nuclear power plant sparked a weekend run on iodine tablets as far away as Finland. Now, you might not remember this, but back in 2008, our government decided that they will not give anti-radiation pills to millions of people who live 10 to 20 miles from a nuclear plant because they said there are more effective ways to protect people in case of an accident or terrorist attack. The pills, they said, offer negligible additional protection against radiation exposure for those who live outside a 10-mile radius of a reactor. John Marburger, then President George W. Bush's top science advisor, made that statement. Dr. Robin Falkov with us. She has practiced homeopathy for more than 25 years. Robin, first of all, that statement that these pills won't help if you live beyond a 10-mile radius, is that true or not?
I can't address that, but on the to be on the side of safety, the pills will provide protection by saturating the thyroid gland so that it will not absorb the radioactive thyroid. They will not protect against other forms of radiation. But the issue with these pills, and I'm very conservative, which I think you know, is that there are certain health conditions, which I want our audience to understand, must be told to one's physician before taking this medication. Things like Addison's disease, bronchitis, cystic fibrosis, dehydration, goiter, heart disease, high levels of potassium, kidney disease, thyroid disease, tuberculosis. There are more conditions. I will be updating those details on my site. And then there are other drugs that can interact with the potassium iodide. The birth control pill Yasmin and other birth control pills, lithium, heparin, there are things that have to be carefully checked because a lot of people are panicking now and they think, well, they've got to rush out and start taking this. They've got to check first because the side effects could be very, very dangerous.
Good point. And what's the difference, Robin, between potassium iodide and iodine pills? Are they similar?
It's similar, but this is a form that the body can use that will be absorbed. It's a more specific form to be taken. And unfortunately, I was calling around before the show to see what local pharmacies have, like Walgreens.
Sure.
And the pharmacist was telling me that he has not reordered because people were using potassium iodide before they took drug tests so they could skew the results. So we have health stores selling out, online, online websites selling out.
Well, and how do you know what you're getting is reputable?
That's, I've dealt with Life Extension Foundation for years. I'm ordering from a medical supply company tomorrow. They're getting back to me with the potency of the formula, and I will then be able to share that information. There's an Iosat form of potassium iodide, and I've seen websites that now are selling it for 10 times the price.
Oh, jeez.
So, yeah, that's what happens when people are panicking and there's a potential.
Gouging.
Yeah.
Gouging. All right, Robin, we're going to put your website up on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Word to the wise, just be Be very, very careful. And the devastating earthquake and tsunami in Japan has actually moved the island closer to the United States and shifted the planet's axis. The quake caused a rift 15 miles below the seafloor that stretched 186 miles long and 93 miles wide. The areas closest to the epicenter of the quake jumped a full 13 feet closer to the United States. That was a big one. It is the world's fifth largest quake in recorded history. In Cape Canaveral, a space shuttle worker fell to his death at the launch pad, the first fatality there in decades. Medics rushed to the pad. They were unable to revive him. He's identified as James Vanover, an engineer for United Space Alliance, a NASA contractor. Russia's going to make more money by sending our astronauts up into space. NASA has already committed to paying Russia millions of dollars to hitch rides into space. They were charging us $56 million for each rocket ride. Now they are bumping it to $63 million in 2014. And more than 4 out of 10 American millionaires say they do not feel rich. Aw. Indeed, many would need to have at least $7.5 million, they say, in order to feel that they were truly rich. Some 42% of the more than 1,000 millionaires surveyed by Fidelity said they did not feel wealthy at all. Respondents had at least $1 million in investable assets, excluding any real estate or retirement accounts. Director Quentin Tarantino is suing his neighbor, fellow Oscar winner Alan Ball, for failing to curb his intolerable loud macaws. Tarantino's lawsuit says that the American Beauty writer's exotic birds emit obnoxious pterodactyl-like screams, which stop him from being able to work. Here's what a macaw sounds like. Yeah, I wouldn't want to live next to that either. In the suit filed at L.A. County Superior Court, the Pulp Fiction director describes the birds as a large variety of wild parrot known for an intolerable loud screech and for behaving badly in captivity. He's asking the court to issue an injunction against Alan Ball, ordering him to halt the bird's noise, and also asks that his costs be paid by the defendant. You know, after a horrific car accident that paralyzed his son in 2004, Kevin Malarkey witnessed extraordinary reports from his son about meetings with Jesus, angels, and visits to heaven. Up next, we talk about the boy who came back from heaven on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Kevin Malarkey is a Christian therapist with a counseling practice near Columbus, Ohio. He earned a graduate degree from Ohio State University. His academic background includes studies in clinical psychology, psychological assessment, and family counseling. I mentioned this incredible story. After this horrific car accident that paralyzed his son in 2004, Kevin witnessed extraordinary reports from his son about meetings with Jesus, angels, and visits. They've documented all this with the boy who came back from heaven. It's a big story. It's been going all around the country. Here's Kevin Malarkey for the next 2 hours on Coast to Coast AM. Hello, Kevin. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, George.
Tell me what it was. Now, did anything happen spiritually or supernaturally with your son prior to the accident?
Nothing of note. Nothing that doesn't happen in the life of any little boy. I mean, he had a relationship with God. He read his Bible. He was just a pretty normal kid. So nothing really out of the ordinary.
Okay, so then after the accident, what started happening? And then tell us about the accident. Tell us about that event. I hate to pain you with that, but...
Oh, no, it's okay. I think the key thing to know is that in the car accident, that he suffered what's called internal decapitation. And what that means is that, for all intents and purposes, his head was not attached to his body.
Oh, my God.
The spinal cord was pretty much severed, and obviously that's generally leads to a fatality. And what we found after the accident, again, later in the interview, if you'd like, we can get into what happened exactly, but
sure.
I want to address your question. He told us after he came out of a coma, everything that happened during the accident, the things that happened afterwards, and then he had stories of heaven and all kinds of things. So the fact that, you know, his head was not really even attached to his body and he knew everything that happened during that time definitely caught our attention.
Absolutely. Now, how old was he when this happened in 2004?
He was 6 years old.
6 years old. Okay, so he's growing up. And what's his situation now, his physical situation?
Well, right now he's physically he's quadriplegic. He doesn't move below his neck. He breathes on a ventilator, although he can get off it from a surgery that he had. He can get off it for, you know, maybe 5-10 minutes at a time now, and hopefully long-term he'll be able to get off it completely. But he drives a wheelchair with his chin. He homeschools. He does school online. He gets on the internet and surfs by using a mouse that he does with his mouth. And so he's on time in school, and he's just an overall pretty neat kid.
Okay. You know, and one thing, this is not part of the interview, but I do want to tell you this. I want to offer this to you. We've got a dear friend of the program here, Dr. Christian Wild, who works with doctors. He's an author. He's a researcher. He's a writer. He's a reporter. He has a doctor in Portugal. His name's a Dr. Lima, who has worked on now 165 quad and paraplegic people. 165, and he's got most of them moving around and walking now, Kevin.
Wow.
He uses stem cells. With your permission, I'd like to get Christian in touch with you, and at your own time, you two talk about this possibility, if you would.
Oh, sure.
Because it's truly, he's doing some remarkable work right now. And you know what? It never hurts.
That's right.
It never hurts. Now, after he came out of this situation, did he start acting strange from the get-go in terms of spiritually?
The weird thing was, George, he was perfectly normal, acted totally normal while he talked about these incredible things. He wasn't excited. He wasn't scared. He talked about him like you'd talk about anything else. And it came out slowly. We didn't really press it. It was pretty normal conversation about pretty extraordinary things.
And I assume you thought you were going to lose him.
Well, yeah. Well, first of all, I thought he lost it, you know.
Yeah.
One of the things I get asked a lot is, you know, what would you say to the person who reads your book and they're skeptical? And my answer is generally, I'll bet they're not as skeptical as I was.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I had seen what my father is a physician at Ohio State, and he had kind of taken me through the X-ray. And I mean, I remember him just saying, I said, so he had two injuries, right? One at the spinal cord and one in his brain. And he said, no, it's just one giant injury field. And so when he started telling us some of these stories that we'll discuss later, I thought he had brain damage. That was my first reaction.
Oh, yeah, and that's very normal to think that.
Which was also my worst fear. I mean, I was like, I thought, okay, if he doesn't move, that's okay. But if he's not Alex anymore, that's going to be unbearable. And so he came out and he started talking eventually, and I thought, uh-oh. One of the first things he said to me is, are you my father? And I'm like, yeah.
That took you back a little bit, didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well, again, I thought, okay, he has no recollection of me. He doesn't remember me. But he had quite another tale to tell following that comment as well.
I bet he did. How is he reacting now? Not physically, but in terms of this spiritual aspect of his life. Is he aware of what he really went through?
Yes, he's fully aware of what happened.
Okay.
He actually, I was unconscious during the car accident. He was as well, but he has total recall of everything that occurred. He has total recall of the time that he spent in heaven.
What happened in the accident, by the way? I mean, did you get,
well,
hit another car? What happened?
Yeah, we actually, our fourth child had been born later at the tail end of that week, and people wanted to stay home and get rest, and Alex and I went to church, and we were actually on our way home from church. We had just moved to the town about 6 weeks earlier. We were just trying a new way home. I had taken him to a playground, and we were just trying a country road, and I thought I could take a left turn, and in fact, it was one of those where it was cut out so that people kind of coming in perpendicular manner could take a left, but there was no road to turn left onto. You had to pull up a little bit further. Well, I looked out down the road, and there was nothing there. So I just pulled up to that next part and turned left. I did not look a second time, which was my error. And it turns out that there was a huge dip in the road. There was a car down in the bottom of that swell. And we figured it was probably going about 55 miles an hour. I never saw it. I pulled right in front of it. And we got blindsided. And I was actually ejected from the car. I flew about 50 feet. At the point of impact, I was knocked unconscious. I woke up next to the car. I didn't know that I was ejected till a week.
All right, hold on, Kevin. I want to talk with you a little bit more about the accident. Then we'll get into Alex and his communication with the angels. Well, we've got an Instapoll going regarding the U.S. nuclear program. Go up there and cast your vote. And basically, given the recent explosions at some of Japan's nuclear power plants after the tsunami, should America? And then we ask you three questions. And 46% of you, which is leading the pack, says continue its current nuclear power policy without change. That's interesting. Go take a look at it. Register your vote. I'll be back with Kevin Malarkey as we talk about the boy who came back from heaven on Coast to Coast AM. Kevin, let's get back into the accident. So you kind of go down into almost like a little type road ravine. There's a car coming 55 plus miles an hour. Bang.
Yeah. As I was saying, I was ejected from the car, and Alex remained in the car. When I woke up, I just was trying to figure out where my son was. I didn't really know what happened. There had been an emergency room nurse in the car behind us, and she had come up and just kind of told me what happened. So I ran over to the car, and Alex was in the car, and his head was just at a bad angle. The rest of his body looked pretty normal, but his head was kind of hanging, and I just remember thinking, there's two options here. One, he has a concussion. Or two, he's dead.
Yeah.
Your mind doesn't really know what to do other than that in times like that. You know, there's that hopeful part that thinks, okay, we're fine, we get out of this. And then there's the other part that's just like, he's dead. They got him out of the car. He wasn't able to breathe on his own. And so they did some things for that. And I just remember looking into his eyes. They were blank. They put him onto a helicopter. And I wasn't able to go with him because they assumed that I would be injured. But I wasn't, actually.
That was a miracle all by itself.
Yes. Alex would later actually tell me that he saw angels carry me out of the car. And I'm 6'2". I weigh about 220. I was in a Honda Civic. And I came out of a car after being hit by another one going 55 miles an hour, and I had no injuries. So I haven't heard a better explanation yet. So.
When did the shock hit you, Kevin? Because I'm sure it did eventually.
I think immediately. Standing there in the middle of the road after a while when a helicopter came and there's ambulances, there was a mom and two kids in car seats in the other car, people that had come from around. And I just remember thinking, I am the worst person on the planet. I didn't even know what I did, but I knew all these people were there because I screwed up.
That was an accident, Kevin. Accidents happen. That's why they call them accidents.
And you know what was great? The police officer there told me that, and he would call me almost every day and tell me that. And, you know, I came to understand that that's true. I mean, these things do happen. And amazingly, no one in the other car was hurt.
Well, that's a miracle, too.
Yeah, so there was a total of five people involved, and Alex was the only one that was injured.
Okay, so off goes Alex. How long was he in a coma?
He was in a coma for 2 months.
Two straight months.
Yes. They didn't think that he would live. We actually, that first meeting, you know, you look at the x-ray and have the talk with the doctor.
The horrible talk with the doctor.
Yeah, it was not pleasant. I mean, the guy was just telling what medically should occur, and none of it was good. And but one of the things I remember is my wife telling him he was wrong. And that Alex would live, and he would be fine.
He was on a respirator, I take it, right away, right?
Yes. Yes. He had some intervention there at the emergency room before he was brought up to ICU.
Did you think for a moment you were going to pull the plug?
I was asked to pull the plug at some point in the coma. No, believe it or not, it never entered my mind. It was funny, on the way two, I had about a little over an hour drive, and the person that gave me the ride had driven by the accident site. And I pulled out of him, and he thought, you know, there's no way Alex is alive. And so I was kind of preparing myself for him to not be alive when I got there. But once I got there and he was alive, it never occurred to me that he could die.
When he pulled out of the coma, were you there? How did you get the call?
Yeah, there was times, it was weird. There were times when he would kind of smile and do things. But the time that he came out never really was cloudy again. It was really funny. Funny is an interesting word to use, but it was. We would do various things to try to make him laugh. And I mean, you know, what do you do?
In the coma state.
Yeah.
Okay.
And one day we were on there doing all that stuff, and his brother, Aaron, who was four at the time, started slapping himself in the face really hard, and Alex smiled.
Eyes are closed, right?
His eyes kind of popped open a little bit.
Huh.
And so Aaron, thinking I'm onto something, started smacking himself even harder, and Alex just woke up. We thought we were going to have to admit the other one to the hospital. He's hitting himself.
You know,
the more Alex smiled, the more he whacked his face. And finally, somebody just grabbed Aaron and goes, okay, you can stop now. And that's the moment we really remember Alex kind of coming back and staying with us.
My God. You must have. Oh, my. How do you describe it?
It was wonderful. Because, you know, it was 2 months of looking at his body laying there and just not knowing if he would ever, you know, would you ever be able to look into his eyes, ever be able to talk to him or anything. So that was a pretty neat day.
At what point, Kevin, did he start communicating with you about these heavenly things?
Well, the first one that I remember, he was unable to talk for a while, and he had signs that he did with his mouth that he learned with an occupational therapist, and he moved his mouth one way for a yes and in another way kind of, I believe it was, he puckered his mouth for no, and then he'd kind of roll his eyes, and that was kind of his catch-all phrase. And we had an experience one evening. I was there with a friend of ours named Margaret, and Alex normally looked right at me at all times when I was in the room after he woke up. Then we would talk, and then he would just say yes or no. Well, he wasn't paying any attention to me. And Margaret noticed, and I noticed, and we're like, I wonder what's wrong with him. So we started asking questions. Are you okay? And he did his sign for yes, and does something hurt? And we asked him so many questions. And I mean, it wasn't probably in the first 100 questions I asked, but I just asked him one time, is there an angel in here? And his face lit up. And he gave me the yes signal.
Huh.
I don't know why after all those questions I asked him. I think I was just running out of questions.
Right, yeah.
And so then I said, one angel? No. Two? No. Three? No. 10? No. Is the room full? And again, lit up. Yes. And I'm like looking at Margaret. Kind of, I was real glad another human being was there.
But do you believe him at this point? You don't, do you?
Not really.
No.
I mean, you want to.
But you figure, all right, you know, he's just come out of a coma.
Yeah.
He's, you know, this is his therapy. If it works for him, so be it.
Yeah. Is it his imaginary best friend?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or is he hallucinating?
Is he hallucinating? That's
These
true.
These are the kinds of things, yeah, I think that I'm initially thinking because...
But even as a religious person, you are, you don't stop and think at that moment. Nobody does.
Yes.
This is real.
Yeah, it's so funny too, George, because one of the things I talk about a lot is do you believe what you believe or do you just talk about what you believe? And one of the things that I was confronted with was I was caught off guard by the very presence of the things I profess to believe.
Yeah.
And so you got to go to another level to say, do I believe this? And it's funny because really everything in me believed him. There was nothing inauthentic about it, but I think it's just your own personal struggle to try to come to grips with what does it mean if that's true.
Did Alex ever eventually say anything about family members, dearly departed ones, anything like that?
In terms of being in heaven?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, his experience in heaven, when he went, it was, he said that he, in the middle of the accident, went to heaven and began to look down on things at that point. If I could just back up a second.
Sure.
He recalled the entire car accident. He told what happened. He said, I saw the car. He actually apologized, told me the accident was his fault, which broke my heart as well.
His fault? Why? Did he,
yes,
did he get you to turn around or something?
He said, Daddy, I asked you a question and you turned slightly to answer me, which I have no recollection of. But he said that, and he said, I saw the car. I should have told you the accident was my fault. Well, then he gave me a little more detail. He said, Daddy, it felt like a knife went down my neck. And he describes in the first chapter of our book, he describes it in pretty great detail what he experienced. But then he said, angels took you out of the car, five angels, one named John held your head, and the other four put you on the side of the road. And that made me feel a little better. But then the devil showed up in the front seat, pointed at me, and told me the accident was my fault.
The devil shows up?
Yes.
Man, he doesn't miss an opportunity, does he, Kevin?
Well, the thing that I find really kind of fantastic or amazing there is you think of even the devil would take a moment to let one go by.
You would think.
You know, if ever there was a time where he said, you know, this one's under control, I'm going to leave it alone.
Yeah, I'll come back later.
Yeah, I give the message in churches a lot. And one of the times things I do right there is I pause and I say, you know, I believe in angels. I believe in demons. I believe in spiritual warfare. And you need to know that your opponent, the devil, would take a kid whose head wasn't attached, who felt a knife go down his back, who just experienced literally hell on earth, and just feel the need to say, oh, by the way, it's time for me to lay some guilt on you as well.
Yeah, he's relentless.
That's the guy we're doing battle with. And I think that I want people to know that.
Well, it's something we all need to know about.
Yes. So he told me that, and that was, there was kind of something there that was also kind of amazing and humorous. I said, well, what did the angels look like that carried me out of the car? And he said, Daddy, they looked like professional wrestlers with wings.
Well, they had to. You were too big.
Exactly. They had to bring in the jumbo angels.
Yeah, exactly.
But all kidding aside, it was funny because I said, you know, Alex, I have a question for you. I'm going to put my dad hat back on. When did you see professional wrestling exactly?
Yeah.
He goes, oh, I snuck some in. I was like, okay, we'll talk about that later. But he said, yeah, they set you on the side of the road. And he said, then I went through this white tunnel, and there was light. And then he said, what are those instruments called with the long strings? And I said, harp. He goes, oh, they played that. It was awful. I think only a kid describes the music coming from heaven as awful.
As awful, right.
He said it was terrible.
It wasn't up-tempo music at all.
Yes. And then he did have the situation where he met with God. And another interesting conversation we had at one point, he said, Daddy, I hope you're not mad at me because I love you and I love Mommy. But I asked God if I could stay.
He wanted to stay, didn't he?
Yeah, he said, Daddy, I love you. This is nice, he said, but that's home, and I wanted to stay.
Why did they send him back?
Well, he said that Lord said he had work for him to do, and Alex also believes that he's going to be a missionary one day. And so we think that that is a part of it.
I bet he will be.
Well, and what we try to tell him is that I believe he already is. Our book is selling all over the world.
It is.
Which
there's
means
no question about
people
it.
Are hearing about it all over the world. I've spoken with someone in Ukraine this week. I speak regularly with people in Korea and all over the world, Australia. And I'm like, Alex, you are a missionary now. He says he's not.
What was the point, Kevin, when you realized this is not some little kid hallucinating? This is not the figment of his little imagination, yeah, that this is real. At what point? What happened?
I think when he started to do a couple of the following things. One, not only did he describe what happened in the car, he says, I felt a lot better when they took you away in the ambulance. And I said, Alex, it was funny. I said, now I've got you. And I'm thinking, why do we try to disprove people to think about things like this? Why are we so quick? You know, of all the things we accept as truth, why do we fight off kind of some good stuff happening. Now,
physically, he was already gone in the helicopter, right?
Yeah, well, that was my point.
Yeah.
You're with me, George. I said, no, I got you, because you left in the helicopter. There's no way you could have seen me in the ambulance. He said, Daddy, I didn't watch you from the helicopter. I watched you from heaven. I was like, oh, okay, pardon me. And I had never told him that I went in an ambulance. I was not going to tell him that I experienced anything. I was so embarrassed. You know, they call it survivor guilt or whatever. Hey, I know you had your head torn off and all that, but you know, I'm in an ambulance ride. I mean, I didn't tell him I was in an ambulance. So I'm thinking, okay, how did he know that? And then in a discussion with my wife, they had a disagreement about what color jumpsuit the man on the helicopter was wearing. And my wife said, look, I know what color it is. And he said, you're wrong. It was this color. And so she said, okay, I'm calling him. And she called the guy, and the guy said Alex was right.
Jeez.
My wife said, what do you mean Alex was right? I saw you. He said, yeah, you saw me at the hospital. I'd already changed my clothes.
There's no way an unconscious little boy could physically know this.
No. Not only that, he's arguing with us about the facts. So people think, oh, you know, you fed him the facts. I'm like, he knew stuff we didn't know. And then again, when they were working on him at the hospital initially, before we were able to see them, he said, Daddy, I watched it from above the room. And I'd heard stories like that. And I'm like, okay, what did you see? He said, they were talking about how I was going to die. And I said, did that scare you? And Alex is a really funny kid, too. I said, did it scare you, son? He said, hello, Daddy, lap of Jesus. No.
Well, Kevin, he's 12 or 13 now, right?
Yeah, he's 12.
He's 12 years old. He's going to be 13 this year, I guess, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, next month.
This happened when he was 6.
Yes.
So we're talking 7 years. 7 years has gone on since this happened. I haven't heard about this story. I would have been one of the first to hear about these stories. I mean, these things come to this program.
Yeah.
What took you so long to want to tell people about this?
Well, I felt no urge really to share our story. I think for one, we were busy with our own lives. My wife, she doesn't like when I say it, but kind of became a full-time nurse at that point.
Mm-hmm.
We homeschool, so I had to take some of those responsibilities. We had, you know, the first year he went back to the hospital 7 times or 8 times, I think. We're just busy doing our life. And eventually, though, I started to see the way that what had happened to our family was positively affecting people. Now, we had a website when the accident, right after it happened, called PrayForAlex.com. And that site's still in existence, so people could go up and see live what happened as we went through it. So, you know, we're not making it up, and we didn't change the details. It's there. And but after 2 months, there were 1 million hits on that website.
1 million.
1 million. And we're just a family from Central Ohio, you know. And so that was a hint that there was a lot of interest. But then we just really just saw that people were positively impacted by our situation. And, you know, sometimes when you help someone, you say, no, it was my pleasure. Well, what I realized was it really was their pleasure. And one example was, there was a radio DJ, the radio station had come down to pray for Alex. He was still in a coma at the time, couldn't open his eyes or anything. She walked out of the room and said, Kevin, I just did a 2-week trip to mission trip to India. It was incredibly impactful. It's the closest I've ever felt to God until I walked into your son's room.
She felt it.
She felt it. And there was no twinkle in his eye. He was out. And we'd start to hear things like this. We'd start to talk to people like, when I'm around Alex, one woman told me, actually the woman that was with me the first time we saw when Alex saw the angels, she said to me one time, that was one of the top spiritual experiences of my life. And I said, what, the angels? She said, no, praying for your son.
It works.
But that was meaningful to her. There was something happening. And Alex had what ended up being a kind of a world-famous surgery called the Christopher Reeve surgery. He had Christopher Reeve's surgeon, Dr. Raymond Anders, up in Cleveland. And they did the surgery, and he was the first child ever to have this device implanted that will eventually help him to breathe on his own. Well, it became an international news story.
Let's go the distance. Let's get him stem cells and see what happens.
Yeah. I think he's going to walk again. I really do. Matter of fact, our license plate on his van is "Will Walk." But when we had that surgery, we were doing some interviews afterwards, and the AP writer said to me, you should write a book. I kid you not, George. My response was, about what?
Kevin, stay with us. We're going to come back. We'll talk more about this incredible story, the boy who came back from heaven. And with our last hour here with Kevin Malarkey with a split show tonight, we're going to take your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.